Support for Studio 360's podcast comes from the car company Scion. As part of its Motivate program, Scion invited 50 semifinalists to LA, where they were provided mentors, attended seminars, and met with advisors. Then, the 10 that most improved received $10,000, a Scion, and continued access to mentors. You can track their success at scion.com.
My name is General Zod.
It's summer, which means, in a world where movie blockbusters are unleashed, the fate of humankind is once again in jeopardy.
Surrender within 24 hours, or watch this world suffer the consequences.
I'll talk today with the actor Michael Shannon, the tall oddball from Revolutionary Road and Boardwalk Empire. He is now Superman's arch nemesis in The Man of Steel. And I'll talk with the director of last summer's blockbuster, The Avengers, who's back with a movie about sex, betrayal, power, written by one of the biggest names in show business, William Shakespeare.
Do not you love me?
Troth, no, more than reason.
Well,
Joss Whedon, the Hollywood Slayer, on his new movie, Much Ado About Nothing. That and more ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 models. Arriving this summer with exclusive Scion 10 features, you can learn more and download Scion's 10-year anniversary music release at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. This week, Sofia Coppola's movie The Bling Ring comes out. It's about a group of fame-obsessed teenage girls in L.A. who burglarize the celebrities they idolize.
I think there must be some sort of misunderstanding. We're not here to clean your bathtub or organize your closets or make you happy.
Really?
Yeah. We're here to kill you.
It's just one of a sudden surge of movies about girls gone wild. Nancy Jo Sales, author of The Bling Ring, explains how we arrived in this bad girl Hollywood moment.
Since there have been movies that have been bad girls, I mean, the first thing that Garbo said in a movie was, "Give me a whiskey and don't be stingy, baby." It's a very famous line.
That's later in this hour. But first, when it comes to mass market consumer product design, there's Apple and then there's everyone else, which is why the company's big annual software developers conference this week was interesting. For the first time in a long time, Apple's leaders seemed like they really had something to prove. An executive even addressed the post-Steve Jobs negative chatter directly.
Can't innovate anymore, my ass.
One of the biggest announcements at this year's Applepalooza was a wholesale redesign of the operating system and interface and look and feel for iPhones and iPads that will appear this fall. The company seems to be admitting it's fallen a little behind design-wise the last few years. Bonnie Siegler is a major graphic designer with her own firm called 8.5. She is chairing the big biennial National Conference of Graphic Designers this fall. And she joins me now to talk about the design changes at Apple. Bonnie, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt.
So, significantly overhauling your most familiar and widely used designs as they've done sort of is a tacit admission that something was wrong, isn't it?
I don't think so. I think it's just evolutionary. It's more like the other guys caught up a little. It's evolutionary, and it's survival of the fittest of the new characteristics. So Apple invented the thing. The other guys came along.
Invented meaning this kind of user interface with cool little intuitive
smartphone
icons.
Yeah. And then the other guys sort of caught up, and they differentiated from Apple. This guy made a bigger screen. This guy made a different operating system. So now it seems just survival of the characteristics that are best. And Apple sort of looked around, took the things that have been proven to work the best and incorporated them into their new design.
And one of the things that people say, that designers are saying about what they've done, in some measure copying or doing what these Android designers and other people have already done, is flattening the look and feel of everything on the screens of iPads and iPhones. What does that mean?
There was a fake three-dimensional quality to everything. And it really started in 1984 with flat icons. and very simple. That when the Apple didn't, when the machine didn't work, it was a sad face, and when the machine right. worked, it was a happy face. Then they got fancier and fancier
as we got more computer power to do that.
Exactly. So it became that everything on the on a Macintosh was Chrome essentially. Or if it was didn't make sense to be Chrome, it was faux felt or faux wood or faux leather.
Like the bookcase of your newsstand and
exactly.
all that stuff.
Exactly. So now they've done away with that, I think gone back to their roots more, and it's more honest to me. We don't need that anymore. I think it was also in the beginning a way to let people know, this is your bookshelf. See, it looks just like a bookshelf.
So it was a long transitional period from essentially the 20th century to now.
And exactly.
We can get rid of the training wheels.
Exactly.
I mean, the fact that they were still doing these goofy things like this for a podcast app, they recently introduced a reel-to-reel tape recorder. Literally, my children, one of my children, didn't know what that was.
Right.
Were they late in sort of giving up this 3D Trump Loy set of ideas?
I don't think so. Actually, they all use some really old.
You are a shill for Apple, aren't you?
I feel like one. I'm sorry, but they all do use these really old-fashioned icons. A handset for a phone is the universal icon for phone, even though my children have never picked up a handset. An envelope for email. Nobody uses an envelope for email. And the worst one is the old-fashioned microphone for voice memos. It's a microphone like. Even it's like from the 20s, and that means voice
and whereas these are from the 30s or 40s
exactly.
that we're using here.
Yeah, sorry.
And getting rid of the little 3D pictorial realism is not all they're doing, obviously, and they're doing lots of stuff.
My favorite thing is the translucency. They use like a really lovely soft shower glass to communicate different layers. So you sort of see it in the background. It makes everybody look beautiful if there's a photo in the background. And then they also use swiping, which a lot of other interfaces use now.
So in terms of that translucent layer thing, they are still – they're not rejecting 3D illusion altogether. They're just using it in sort of like what seems to be a more integrated way.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they invented the desktop metaphor, and so now it's just more of a stack of papers or apps instead of in the different folders.
Do you think this guy Johnny Ive, who has been their design guru for years and years – did he perhaps always want to do this, and until Steve Jobs was out of the picture, he couldn't like go crazy and do exactly what he wanted with the design, maybe?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it has to be a difficult moment for him, this being the first huge announcement since Steve Jobs died. But and I'm sure there must be. I mean, at his level, there must be things he's always been dying to do, and I hope he gets to do them now. He's a pretty awesome guy.
Well, and now they're putting him in a video online, so he is stepping up. It's as though with Steve Jobs gone, he is the not as famous as Steve Jobs, but the cool kid left at the counter.
Well, I always thought that was a great – that made Apple more compelling. There is a man. There is a human being behind all of these great ideas and this vision. There isn't that at any of the other companies. Who's the Samsung guy?
Right.
We have no idea. So the fact that there is a visionary there – I think makes the products better.
That's a good point. So all designers, as far as I can tell, are Apple nerds, right?
Well, Apple is the only one that always had programs that designers could use. They always made that a focus point. So there was no other option for us.
Right.
Businesses could use Microsoft, but we couldn't.
10 years from now, will that still be true? Do you think they will keep evolving and remaining in 2023? Will you be saying, oh, Apple's still the greatest?
God, I hope so.
Yeah. This has not been a paid political announcement for Apple. Bonnie Ziegler, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bonnie Ziegler is a graphic designer with her own firm, 8 and a Half. She's done work for Saturday Night Live, Lucky Magazine, The Daily Beast, and HBO, among others. So what do you think? Had Apple fallen behind the curve in terms of design? Have they caught up now? Leave us a comment at studio360.org.
Well, that looks good. What's on the inside? What's on the other side? What's on the flip? Tell me what I get. Is it all of what I see? If I give you all of me, then am I tripping? Listen.
In front of your eyes. Never would it seem.
Last week, we launched our Battle of the High School Bands listener challenge.
I used to have rock band back in high school.
I don't even know what it is, but you got it.
Battle of the High School Band.
Excellent! Yay!
The entries are still coming in. One of my current favorites is from a band called Winston Cup 1981 out of Charlottesville, Virginia. And you can hear all the submissions on our SoundCloud page and enter your own high school band's best song in our contest. There are still a few weeks left. Speaking of high school music, Weird Al Yankovic was in the studio the other day, so I asked him to tell me about his high school music scene.
Well, oddly enough, my friends actually didn't want me in their rock bands with an accordion. So I had to basically go out on my own. And I found pretty quickly that if you're serious about the accordion, especially at that point in time, you wound up playing bar mitzvahs and Italian weddings and not so much rock and roll. So I kind of had to go my own direction.
There were no hipsters to rediscover it yet.
You know, I was the original hipster, I'm sorry to say, yes.
But young Alfred Yankovic wasn't totally alone out there. He became a fan of the legendary counterculture DJ Dr. Demento.
The hip DJ from L.A.
When I was growing up, he had a show on the local radio station in Los Angeles, KMET, every Sunday night, the Dr. Demento radio show. And he played music from his extensive personal collection of comedy and novelty recordings. And I was mesmerized, you know. It went on past my bedtime, so I remember I had the AM/FM clock radio under the covers with me in bed listening to the Funny Five every week. I mean, it was exposure to all those artists on the Dr. Demento radio show that kind of let me know that there was a whole different world out there and there was maybe a place for me in pop culture.
They're coming to take me away, ha-ha, they're coming to take me away.
At the age of 16 in the mid-70s, Weird Al sent a song he wrote to Dr. Demento, who then played it on the radio.
It was a cassette. It was, in fact, he wrote me a postcard back saying, maybe not use the cassette that you get like three for a dollar at Kmart. You know, maybe step it up a little bit. But it was like a cheap little cassette on a horrible little compact cassette recorder in my bedroom with my accordion. That was my first recording. It was, I think it was called Belvedere Cruising was the first thing that he actually played on the air. It was a love song about the family car, which was a big black 1964 Plymouth Belvedere with red upholstery.
I don't think that I could cruise in one of those small VWs or zip along the highway in a flashy pickup truck. There's something about a comet that makes me want to vomit, and those Datsuns just ain't worth the fudge sickle. No! Going Belvedere cruising tonight. You got nothing to lose but your life.
And obviously, you know, that's a horrible song. That's just not a good song. But yeah.
But the recording quality makes up for that.
But yeah, the accordion actually saved it because Dr. Demento told me after the fact that, you know, the fact that I was a teenage kid playing the accordion and thinking I was somewhat cool, he thought that was kind of novel and he thought that was worth some airplay.
Did that make you cool in high school?
I don't know about cool.
Cooler?
I don't know. It made me a little bit more well-known. Like, oh, he's the guy on Dr. Demento. So it was nice. I was not the big man on campus, but I was sort of getting known amongst my peers, which I thought was kind of fun.
Weird Al Yankovic will be my guest on next week's show. And remember, we want to hear the music you made as a teenager. It's our Battle of the High School Bands Listener Challenge. All the details are at studio360.org/myhighschoolband. Still ahead this hour in Studio 360, I'll talk with the ultimate quirky indie actor, Michael Shannon, villain in the new Superman movie, about becoming a star.
It's only annoying when people, like, yell at you. Like, from across the street, they're like, hey, come over here! You're in that! You're in the thing! I've seen you! Get over here! That's annoying.
Yeah. That's Michael Shannon, General Zod in Man of Steel.
People of Earth, you are not alone. You are with Michael Shannon and Kurt Anderson on Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Notes for Notes, a nonprofit program in Nashville providing music education to kids. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. You probably know Michael Shannon as that great actor with the unmistakable face who is really good at playing sinister.
You're wrong! It is a battle against the devil himself! I have seen him abroad in the daylight and the night, and by God, I will force him out! What? Is Mr. Lin in charge? Oh. Is Mr. Lin president of the United States? Let me tell you something, boys. I am a cop!
And his General Zod in the new Superman reboot Man of Steel probably isn't going to change that impression much.
For some time, your world has sheltered one of my citizens. I request that you return this individual to my custody.
But in fact, Michael Shannon is a lot more than just a really good angry guy. He can play sympathetic, he can play funny, and he is now, in fact, an internet comedy sensation, which we'll talk more about later. Michael Shannon, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. What?
Just kidding.
Actually, your voice is a lot more Chicago than I anticipated. You grew up, I read, in Kentucky and then did a lot of theater in Chicago, but you sound like a Chicago guy.
Yeah, my father moved to Chicago when I was 5 years old, and I started going up for summer break, Christmas, all that kind of stuff. And then when I was in high school, I spent a couple of years going to school up there, and then I started doing plays up there when I was 16. So I spent most of my 20s in Chicago and a good deal of my 30s there.
So you started in the theater in America's new great theatrical city of Chicago, and then did a bunch of small roles in big movies, and then these big roles in small movies, and now General Zod in Man of Steel. Is arriving in the big summer blockbuster feel good, and this is the right time to do that?
Well, June is usually a fun month. You know, it's the first month of summer. Get to go swimming. It's when my daughter's birthday is. So yeah,
I'm talking about your life more than June.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you mean in the context of my life.
Yeah.
It's kind of a hard thing to say whether I'm ready for it or not. I mean, the whole thing is so gigantic and overwhelming. I mean, just when I went to see the movie for the first time, it kind of paralyzed me. It was just so overwhelming. And, I don't take a huge amount of credit for it. I think Zach is the mastermind behind it and DJ, the visual effects. I mean, the amount of work they did after we were all done shooting is really what makes the movie so incredible, I think. But
is it like you were doing a different thing since you're in front of green screens and blue screens and all that stuff?
You know, there's a lot of times when, like, our spaceship was a set of green stairs. And I would walk down the green stairs, and then I'd go look at the monitor and look at the shot and think, man, that looks really weird and kind of silly. And Zach's like, yeah, but, you know, 2 years from now, it's going to look incredible. And, you know, he's right. You know, they did the work. But, yeah, I don't know. What's it going to do to my life? I've had little inklings of it along the way. You know, when I was in 8 Mile, Bad Boys 2 was quite a popular film.
Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah, you know. So it's kind of like I've been easing into it, I guess.
Right.
Wading into the superstardom.
Has it gotten annoying?
It's only annoying when people, like, yell at you. When people go, like, hey! Like, from across the street, they're like, hey, come over here! You're in the thing! I've seen you! Get over here! That's annoying.
Yeah. Yeah. At least you don't have a catchphrase they can repeat to you 100 times a day.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is like, everybody wants to know, do I say Neil before Zod? Am I going to say Neil before Zod? They want me to say Neil before Zod.
Neil before Zod!
Okay, I'll do it. Neil before Zod.
In the cartoon spinoff of Lil Zod, yeah. I think we can use that.
Neil before Zod.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Was doing that thing in this weird new way, unlike other acting jobs you've done, fun? And would you like to do it again, or is that enough?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are a lot of factors or different components to that. I mean, A, there's the whole experience of working with Zack Snyder, which
who's the director.
Yes, which was an incredible experience. I would work with him anytime, anywhere.
You compared him to Martin Scorsese, I saw in an interview. What does that mean?
Just in terms of the attention they pay to the visual aspect of what they're doing and the composition, and they create the paintings, you know, as they're working. It's not every molecule of every frame is taken into consideration. I mean, Zach spends months and months before he even starts shooting, painting, rendering, drawing. That's literally how he finds his way into a project is through drawing, doing storyboards. And I felt like, I mean, obviously their styles are incredibly different, but the fastidiousness of how they approach the visuals I found similar. That's why I said that.
You've played eccentrics in the past. Was playing this?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't.
Really, you haven't?
No, I haven't.
Okay, good. I retract that. But Zod is this genocidal alien. I mean, to act that, I mean, we make fun, but you have to take that seriously, right?
Well, he's a general. I took that very seriously. I took the fact that he was a general very seriously. I mean, it's an awesome title, general. And when I say awesome, I don't mean like cool. I mean
right,
like,
awe-inspiring.
Yes. I mean, I've played some sergeant and a lieutenant, but a general is it's another thing altogether. And as far as I can tell, he's general of the entire civilization. It's not
right.
Like there's General Tonto or General
right.
Richard, you know.
It's like General Francisco Franco of Krypton.
Yeah, he runs the whole show. And he's just trying to... He's just trying to do his job, you know?
No matter how violent, every action I take is for the greater good of my people.
Did you read Superman as a kid?
No. No, I didn't... I wasn't really into comic books. I had these two cousins that lived out in the boonies, and they had boxes and boxes of comic books, but I didn't have any myself. But when I would go visit them, because my grandma lived out there too, and I would kind of, they'd show me, they're like, look at this one, and look at that one. I'd be like, yeah, that's great.
As a kid, was there a thing that made you think, this acting, I can do that?
Well, you know, it all started with Garrison Keillor. Did you know that?
I did not.
Yeah. They had this thing called Speech Team, which wasn't really like doing a play, but you could do little scenes, little monologues, speeches, you know, that kind of thing, and... they gave me a speech from Lake Wobegon Days.
Huh.
It was called Booger Days. It was about, I don't know, Garrison going to grammar school, I think. And that was my first monologue. And I never actually got to compete with it. I was an alternate. But I practiced it alone in my bedroom for hours. And that's when I caught the bug. In terms of thinking, I'm a dominant force in this industry. That hasn't really happened yet.
Well, you're on the verge, yeah, maybe, of being a dominant force in the industry now. In Man of Steel and other things you've done, you can do unhinged antagonism really well. I want to play a clip from a few years ago of your terrific performance in Take Shelter. Your character keeps seeing visions of the apocalypse, and everybody around him just thinks he's going bananas.
You think I'm crazy? Huh? Is that what he told you? Well, listen up. There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
So, as you do a role like that and a scene like that, is that a way you have been, you are ever in real life, or is this simply a thing you can perform well?
Well, gee, I don't know. Is that particular clip that you just played something that comes from inside of me? Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I'm faking.
Right.
It's not something like I'm putting on a show. it's something, you know, because I honestly feel very concerned about the world right now. I think it's very volatile. And honestly, I don't see how much longer it can possibly survive. So, yeah, so I do have within me the capacity to get upset about the state of the world.
The director of that movie, Jeff Nichols, you've worked with again and again, most recently on the lovely movie Mud.
I didn't scream in Mud. Is that why you're not playing any clips from it?
It's the producer's choice. I have nothing to do with this.
All right.
Mud,
come here! Mud! Where are you, Mud?
There you go.
Pearl Harbor? No! Groundhog Day?
You have had this big year with Mud and The Iceman and Man of Steel. And then there was this thing that got tremendous amounts of attention online, this insanely vulgar and hilarious letter that a real sorority girl in Maryland had emailed to her sorority sisters, was circulating on the web. And then Funny or Die got you to read it, and it got millions of views. I'm going to play a clip of that.
Cool.
If you were one of the people that have told me, oh, no, boo-hoo, I can't talk to a boy, I'm too sober, then I pity you. Because I don't know how you got this far in life, and with that in mind, don't show up. Unless you're going to stop being a goddamn block for our chapter. Seriously, I swear to God, if I see anyone being a goddamn boner at tonight's event, I will tell you to leave.
Now again, that was a real email sent by a real sorority girl, and that what a brilliant conception to have you do that.
I didn't know anything about it. I'm not a real social media kind of guy. I'm kind of trying to stay away from that. So I got there, and then the letter was all written out on cue cards, and I just gave it how many times we did it? 7 times. And, you know, I had no idea what the hell she was talking about.
You were
about.
Just trusting your people that this would be funny and wonderful?
I had fun doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, obviously, if you look at my resume, I'm kind of game for anything, you know.
Do you think in a career management way, I've got to do this now to show people I can do this other thing, I can do this other thing?
I didn't think that for a long time, but I'm starting to get to the point where I might give in. I might start making decisions based on trying to change the way that I'm perceived. Does that make me a weak person?
No. No. It makes
because
you...
Because at a certain point...
Trying
it's
to
like,
create a sustainable career.
Well, I mean, the thing is like, it'd probably be actually easier for me to just keep playing the same part over and over again. But I like variety.
Yeah.
So... I'm trying. I'm gonna do some. I'm gonna do some things that really surprise people. I signed on for the new Smurfs movie. I wasn't supposed to say anything, but I'm gonna be Papa Smurf in the next Smurfs movie.
I'm not sure I believe you.
You don't get to question me on air.
No,
I'm a bunch of total strangers. Who are you to question me?
I read that you were once up, seriously up for the lead role in a romantic comedy by a.
I was, yeah.
Famous director.
No, that's a totally true, serious story. But I lost out to somebody who does nothing but romantic comedy.
What was the movie?
Jesus, I can't say that.
No?
I'd get in so much trouble if I said that. I'm already in trouble about the Smurfs thing. I don't need more heat.
Okay. I'd like to see you as Papa Smurf.
Or maybe like a Smurf version of Zod.
Michael Shannon. It has been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Kurt.
Michael Shannon plays General Zod in Man of Steel, which is out right now. And you can find out what he's been reading, watching, and listening to by checking out his 3 for 360 at studio360.org.
Simple as can be. La, 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 la. Sing a happy song.
Kneel before Zod!
You can hear my whole unedited conversation with Michael Shannon online. And really, you ought to, because Michael Shannon is one of the most oddly entertaining people I've met in a long time. That's at Studio360.org. The movie Violet and Daisy opens this week. It stars James Gandolfini.
I hate to interrupt or anything, but don't you think you better reload?
And, no surprise, hitmen are the main characters. But the hitmen this time around are actually hit girls, Violet and Daisy.
Search him, Daisy.
It's about a couple of teenagers who kill for the money so they can go shopping.
Just keep a lookout while I go and dream about a dress.
Looking at this season's movies, I noticed that there are a bunch that are about girls behaving really, really badly. Harmony Korine's Spring Breakers featured college girls in bikinis committing armed robbery. And Sofia Coppola's new movie, The Bling Ring, out this week, is about a group of celebromaniacs who break into famous people's houses in L.A.
Come on, let's go to Paris's. I want to rob.
Nancy Jo Sales wrote the Vanity Fair article about the real-life gang that inspired the movie. She explains what may be behind our current fascination with girls gone bad.
Since there have been movies, there have been bad girls. I mean, the first thing that Garbo said in a movie was,
"Give me a whiskey. And don't be stingy, baby." Live fast, die young,
bad girls, give it well. So, since we've been able to watch people doing things in the movies, we've wanted to watch bad girls being bad.
When I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
But what's interesting to look at is how, through different eras, bad girls mean different things. When I was a kid, the bad girl was Tatum O'Neill in Paper Moon.
I don't want you smoking in the car tomorrow. What?
I didn't say nothing. I'm just listening to you.
I was 9 years old, and my mother would not allow me to see this movie. So in my own first act of badness, one afternoon, I got on my bike, and I rode to the theater, and I went to see it.
I want my money. You took my $200.
I thought she was awesome, you know, because she was so bad. And maybe that's exactly why my mother didn't want me to see it. So bad girls are a mainstay of American cinema. In Spring Breakers, the bad girls are four girls who want to go on a trip to spring break in Florida.
All I know is I'm not going to sit here another day.
Spring break. So in order to fund their trip, they rob a fast food restaurant.
Get down!
Spring break forever, bitches.
And then, you know, there's a lot of butt shots of these so-called Disney princesses' behinds. I hear the drizzle of the rain. The bad girls in Violet and Daisy are two girls who seem to want to buy a dress.
Barbie Sunday has a new fashion line.
Be your best in my new signature dress. Who's better than you, girl?
Oh, man!
But they're assassins.
Do you know why we're here? We're here to kill you.
They say it's better than data entry.
Say, mister, you got any other leads on where I could get some more bullets?
The Bling Ring is based on a true story. In The Bling Ring, these are fashionistas. They're girls who want stuff. And they really robbed the homes of many celebrities, including Paris Hilton, Lindsay Lohan.
Oh my God, this is Balmain.
They want beautiful things to wear out at night when they go to nightclubs so that they can live like celebrities.
It's so cute. Oh my God, check it.
Hey, I can be the answer. What I think is so interesting about these three movies is that they're girls gone bad who have no sense of it being bad. It's just, I want to go on spring break. Let's rob. I need something to wear to the club tonight. Let's go steal it from Paris Hilton. I want that dress. I'm going to kill for it.
Keep a lookout while I go and dream about a dress.
Is it sensationalism? Is it exhibitionism? Of course, but little girls are a symbol of innocence.
Don't you like cookies?
Those oatmeal?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any milk?
Movies are, in a way, a reflection of a reality. They're not just exploiting reality. They are a reality to a certain extent. And women and girls often seem to be used as a device in which to work out our own problems in our culture. So does it make us more comfortable with violence to watch little girls killing people? Maybe. Does it make us feel better about drone strikes to watch, you know, pretty blue-eyed Violet and Daisy killing big criminals? Maybe.
Why are you looking at us funny?
It's just that you girls aren't what I expected.
If you have little girls, you know, shooting up people, I mean, you know, what's next? Are we going to see Honey Boo Boo robbing a liquor store? I don't know. I mean, I think that bad girls seems to be exactly what people want to see for some reason.
Just call me Angel of the Mind.
That's journalist Nancy Jo Sales, who chronicled the real-life girls in her book, The Bling Ring. In a minute, Joss Whedon takes a piece of fatherly advice to heart.
Every time I come to New York, he'd be like, when are you going to make a real grown-up picture without the vampires and the rocket ships? And I was like, never. It's never going to happen.
Never say never. I'll talk with Whedon about his delightful new movie, Much Ado About Nothing. That's right here in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Wonderheads, a Portland theater company specializing in mask performances. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. This summer, the humorist Jack Handy, the creator of Saturday Night Live's Deep Thoughts, will publish his first novel called The Stench of Honolulu. To celebrate his new book, we are officially declaring June Jack Handy Month. To whet your appetite, here is an excerpt of Handy reading a piece he recorded for us a few years back, Ideas for Paintings.
Ideas for Paintings by Jack Handy. Because I love art, I am offering the following ideas for paintings to all struggling artists out there. Some of those artists may be thinking, hey, I've got good ideas of my own. Really? Then why are you struggling? These ideas, all 12 of them, are free of charge. I only ask that when you have completed a painting, as a courtesy to me, you sign it Jack Handy and your name or initials. And if the painting is sold, I get approximately all the money. Good luck. Let's get painting. Idea number one, stampede of nudes. The trouble with most paintings of nudes is that there isn't enough nudity. It's usually just one woman lying there and you're looking around going, aren't there any more nudes? This idea solves that. What has frightened these nudes? Is it the lightning in the background? Or did one of the nudes just spook? You don't know, and this creates tension. Idea number two, made you look. This idea is difficult to execute but could turn out to be a masterpiece. It depicts a grandly dressed lady looking straight at you. At first her look seems to say, quick, look behind you. So you turn around, and when you look back at her again, her expression now seems to be one of smug satisfaction. Number three, the bleak hotel. A man is staring out the window of a bleak hotel room. He looks depressed. From the side, flying through the air, is a football. And you realize, if he's depressed now, just wait until he gets hit in the head by that football. Idea number four, the repentant Cameron Diaz. Cameron Diaz, her tear-streaked face lit by a candle, gazes wistfully at a picture of me. Number five, the weary peasants. Some tired-looking peasants are walking down a road at sunset, carrying sheaves of wheat. A nobleman in a fancy coach is coming up from behind. This creates drama, because you're thinking, why don't those peasants get out of the way? Number six, self-portrait with startled expression. The key here is to be able to constantly startle yourself as you're painting. One option is to hire a professional startler, but that can get expensive. The best ones are from Ireland. Be sure to use opening the bill from your startler as a free startle.
That's Jack Handy reading his ideas for paintings. To hear the rest of his ideas, go to studio360.org. And we'll be featuring excerpts from his new novel, The Stench of Honolulu, that Jack recorded just for us, starting next week. For 15 years, Joss Whedon has been a pop cult hero to a generation who consider Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV show he created, to have been the defining, most profoundly entertaining TV show of their generation.
But why can't you people just leave me alone?
Because you are the Slayer. Into each generation, a Slayer is born. One girl in all the world, a chosen one, one born with the strength
and skill to hunt the vampires, to stop the spread of their evil blah, blah, blah. I've heard it, okay?
I really don't understand.
But it turns out Buffy was just Joss Whedon's first brass ring. About 100 million people have seen his adaptation of the Avengers comic book since it came out a year ago, making him the writer-director of the second biggest movie of the 21st century. So what does he do for a follow-up this summer? He invites a bunch of friends over to his house, opens a lot of wine, and films a 400-year-old play. Whedon's new movie is Much Ado About Nothing, Shakespeare's romantic comedy about couples coming together, breaking apart, and coming back together again.
Do not you love me?
Why, no. No more than reason.
Why, then your uncle and the prince and Claudio have been deceived. They swore you did.
Do not you love me?
Troth, no, no. More than reason?
Why, then my cousin, Margaret and Ursula, are much deceived, for they did swear you did.
Most of the film's stars he'd worked with before in TV shows like Firefly and Angel. I'd heard that Whedon made the film while he was working on The Avengers, in between shooting and post-production.
That is true. We started filming a month after we wrapped The Avengers.
Just because you need to keep yourself stressed out and overworked all the time?
You know, it was my wife's idea. She knew that the best vacation I could possibly take after a fairly grueling shoot was to create something with my dear friends that I loved very much, in the house that I loved very much, with a text that I've loved since I was a kid. It was the least stressed out I've ever been.
Really?
Except for the neighbor's yappy dog.
So this, I'm presuming, cost maybe 1% of what the Avengers cost to make?
Probably. I'm not sure we achieved an entire percent.
And you're happy with the way it turned out? I got to say, I went, Joss Whedon doing Much Ado? Maybe. And it was my wife and I practically skipped out of the theater in delight.
I'm so pleased. You know, the thing I was nervous about was, you know, can I pull this off? Partially because, you know, Shakespeare is – he's unapologetic about where he's going with the text. He doesn't, you know, it's not a smooth ride. He's very populist, but he's like, I'm going to go to this very dark drama. I'm going to stay here for a long time.
In this comedy.
Right, exactly. And then I'm going to go to the lowest comedy in the entire thing. Like, he'll just bounce back and forth.
Come, bind them. Come, naughty varlet.
Wait, you are an ass. You are an ass.
Does that not suspect my place? Does that not suspect my years?
And while I appreciate that kind of bipolar filmmaking, it made me a little nervous.
That's funny. You could be the executive giving notes to Shakespeare.
I was very happy not to be able to.
And you shot the movie in your house and your backyard in Santa Monica. Was that just because that was comfortable and familiar?
First of all, my wife built that house, and I knew from the moment I set foot in it that I would want to film something there. And because it's all in one place, that place informs the mood and the feeling and the look of the picture so much, and I was really already comfortable with that. And plus, location scouts were a breeze.
You play it ultimately so straight. So I'm interested in the choices you did make. For instance, they drink a lot. And was that just something from the beginning? Eh, they should be boozing it up all the time?
We referred to the house as the Kennedy compound a lot of the time, where everybody's incredibly elegant, but they're drinking before noon, and the party gets a little out of control, and you kind of just go, maybe I should have left before the wedding. And we wanted to sort of compress it and make it feel like this hothouse of slight debauchery. So it would feel like that modern idea of the way these people, these rich and powerful people live.
Even though they are living in this absolutely contemporary place, wearing suits and ties, which is another interesting choice, but speaking Shakespeare, were there lines you cut for dramatic or intelligibility reasons?
I mean, there's a huge chunk of the text that's out because it's a very long play. The only lines, there was a reference to a rubato that I changed to a gown, and the most important one being, after careful consideration, I decided not to have Benedict say, if I do not love her, I am a Jew. I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to rewrite Shakespeare once in my life. Let's just make it fool.
This, I guess, is your first project without any supernatural elements. You could have gone supernatural with Hamlet or Midsummer Night's Dream or something. Was it a liberating pleasure to deal with people who had no special powers?
You know, it's not a priority with me. It's an argument I've had with my stepfather over the years. Every time I came to New York, he'd be like, when are you going to make a real grown-up picture without the vampires and the rocket ships? And I was like, never. It's never going to happen. And then, you know, less than a year after he died, boom. I'm like, ah, okay, he's right. But I didn't pick it because it doesn't have those things. I mean, at the end of the day, all I'm ever doing is telling stories about people, and whether or not I need some VFX or fake fangs to do that,
right?
It's the same story.
It has been a decade since Buffy went off the air. The Buffy cult, however, remains preternaturally strong. And now I see there's an academic journal devoted to it with articles like The Justice Systems of Slayers and Vengeance Demons, Prosecutorial Discretion in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Is this the fact that there is a field of Buffy studies please you?
It pleases me to no end. I mean, how could it offend me?
Yeah.
Everything we did with enormous thought and care in terms of not only, you know, what the story was, but what it meant.
Right.
And, you know, there are definitely aspects of it that, you know, we didn't think of that people pick up on. But that's true for any story. And the fact that this moves people to sort of go into that field, that they want to sort of break these things down, it's the best compliment.
Because you took it seriously, now they're taking it seriously.
Yeah. And, you know, we didn't expect other people to. We thought, we'll take it seriously, but we won't tell anyone.
You are a third-generation TV writer. Maybe there are others, but I find that amazing. Your father wrote Captain Kangaroo and The Electric Company. Your grandfather wrote Donna Reed, Andy Griffith, Leave It to Beaver, essentially every show I ever watched growing up. Did you ever resist going into the family business?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Television was beneath me because I'm an artist. And my best friend used to taunt me. He was like, you're going to be a third-generation television writer. And his nickname was like 3GTV. I was like, shut up.
That's
3GTV.
Funny.
Yeah. And I was like, never. It felt like stepping down. I didn't watch a lot of American TV growing up. I watched mostly the BBC. I lived with my mom. She was a snob. I'm not going to lie. And and then I was broke, and suddenly I saw things differently.
Why do you think comic books as source material have become so gigantic in the culture in a way they have never been?
I think they really are the sort of 20th century mythos, and you know we grew up with that. We old people now, you know what the comic book brought, which was this very Shakespearean drama, this very high kings, the world, and betrayal, and love, and pain, and every month, and you know bigger than life, but grounded in life. It speaks to us, and I think that you know the people it spoke to the most are now running studios.
And when you make this $600-odd million grossing movie, is there any moment where you go like, nah, I don't want to do that again? I spent years and thousands of hours devoted to that. Enough.
Yeah, there are many moments. There are very few of the other kind. But the story starts to tickle the back of your head. And when it does, you sort of go, well, what if? And my what if kind of exploded in my brain. I realized, oh, I actually – now that I've got the hang of it, now that I feel comfortable in this world, And I don't mean the Marvel world so much as the sort of making a big budget movie right. world. I felt like, okay, now the next time I can really sit down to make a film, maybe a better film than the one I made last time. And it's a very new challenge.
And presumably you now, since it worked out so well, have the leverage with the money guys to – they say, Joss, whatever you say, you're the genius now.
Well, happily, they don't say that. They definitely, you know, if things are on the fence, they fall on the side of trust, which is nice. But they're still making a huge investment, and they're still going to have opinions about things. And the people at Marvel are people that I love working for and respect. And when somebody gives you that much money, you listen to them.
For sure.
And the day you stop is the day you stop being a good storyteller.
Joss Whedon, keep telling stories. A pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing is in theaters right now. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Anne Hepperman,
Eric Malinsky,
Chloe Plant,
Rachel Lewis Krisky,
Ellen Mayer,
Mark Sheely.
Thanks as ever to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. And to find out what's going on at Studio 360, follow us on Twitter. The handles are at Studio360Show and at KB Anderson. That's Anderson with an E. You can also find us on Facebook.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Lilco, a letterpress and design studio in Dallas. Learn more at scion.com. Studio 360 is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
Kneel before Zod.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Almost nothing in the music business says success like a Weird Al parody.
It's sort of a signal that an artist has reached a certain plateau in their career. You know, if you've got the Grammys, they've got the platinum albums, then they get the Weird Al parody. So it's just part of the triumvirate there.
Weird Al Yankovic is my guest next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.